We're going to read from Ezekiel chapter 47. The man brought me back to the entrance of the temple, and I saw water coming out from under the threshold of the temple towards the east, for the temple faced east. The water was coming down from under the south side of the temple, south of the altar. He then brought me out through the north gate and led me round the outside to the outer gate facing east, and the water was flowing from the south side. As the man went eastward with a measuring line in his hand, he measured off 1,000 cubits and then led me through water that was ankle deep. He measured off 1,000 cubits and led me through water that was knee deep. He measured off 1,000 and led me through water that was up to the waist. He measured off 1,000, but now it was a river that I could not cross because the water had risen and was deep enough to swim in, a river that no one could cross. He asked me, "Son of man, do you see this?" Then he led me back to the bank of the river. When I arrived there, I saw a great number of trees on each side of the river. He said to me, "This water flows out towards the eastern region and goes down into the Arabah, where it enters the sea. When it empties into the sea, the water there becomes fresh. Swarms of living creatures will live wherever the river flows. There will be large numbers of fish because this water flows there and makes the salt water fresh. So where the river flows, everything will live. Fishermen will stand along the shore from the En-Gedi to En-Eglaim. There will be places for spreading nets. The fish will be of many kinds, like the fish of the great sea. But the swamps and marshes will not become fresh. They will be left for salt. Fruit trees of all kinds will grow on both banks of the river. Their leaves will not wither, nor will their fruit fail. Every month they will bear, because the water from the sanctuary flows to them. Their fruit will serve for food, and their leaves for healing."
If you were to sum up this passage in one word, it would probably be the word restoration. Restoration. Something kind of cool about restoring things. Taking that which is broken and beaten, worn up and in ruins, and restoring it to its former glory. I really like the idea of kind of taking a beat up car and restoring it with my boys. Me and my boys restore an old car. The only problem with that dream is I'm utterly incompetent when it comes to DIY, and even more so when it comes to cars. But I like the idea of restoring things. And thankfully, though, chapter 47 speaks of one who can and does restore, who is far from incompetent when it comes to restoration. We're in the part of Ezekiel where restoration is the name of the game. So last week we saw how the temple was restored, how it was purified. Glory of God was able to return. With God present, the priests are restored and purified and cleansed. With the priests cleansed, atonement is now able to be made between God and his people once again. Relationship between God and his people is restored. The things that separated them, idolatry, the defilement in the temple, the defilement of the people. Do you remember the early scenes of Ezekiel? The people defiling the temple, the people worshipping other gods in the temple. All of it has been dealt with, cleansed, atoned for. Restoration has been made. And now all that is left is for the land to be restored. And that's what Ezekiel chapter 47 begins to show us. You see, the land is in ruin because of the people's sins. Just flick back to Ezekiel 33. Ezekiel 33, we didn't actually preach this part, Ezekiel 33, 21, but we noted it because it's when the man comes from Jerusalem, the spokesman as it were, and he announces to Ezekiel that Jerusalem has fallen, the city has been destroyed. All that Ezekiel's been saying and prophesying up to that point has now come true. Jerusalem is destroyed. And the people begin to protest. And we read verse 29 of Ezekiel 33. Well, verse 28. "I will make the land a desolate waste, and her proud strength will come to an end. and the mountains of Israel will become desolate so that no one will cross them. Then they will know that I am the Lord, when I have made the land a desolate waste because of all the detestable things they have done. It's just as he promised he would. God promised in Leviticus 18:25 that they could defile the land by their sin. And now it's happened. It's desolate. It's in effect a wasteland. It's inhospitable for people to flourish. Homes are destroyed. A city's in ruins. A land that is barren and fruitless. And you've got to get that in your mind. It's desolate. It's barren. It's fruitless. Think of desert pictures. Think of the new scenes where you see houses destroyed and smoked and ruined. That's the kind of picture you have to have in your mind right at this point. And it's into that picture we then read Ezekiel 47. And Ezekiel, verse 1, is brought back to the entrance of the temple and is shown a trickle of water emerging under the threshold from the south side of the temple. And before he's even had a chance to ponder the significance of why there is a trickle of water coming out from the temple, he's taken outside, verse 2, to the outer gate facing east, where he sees another trickle of water flowing out from the left-hand side of the gatehouse. Looking around, Ezekiel finds his guide is now already striding purposefully eastward, either alongside or in the midst of the stream of water. Ezekiel catches up with him, verse 3, and after about 500 meters, Ezekiel is now splashing in water ankle deep. Another 500 meters, and Ezekiel is wading in water up to his knees. Another 500 meters, and it has reached his waist. At the 2-kilometer mark, Ezekiel is now out of his depth in a river that no one could cross, verse 5. So he returns wisely to the bank. And he now finds that both banks of the river are now covered with a great number of trees on both sides. Verse 7. And then Ezekiel is told that this great river will flow to the eastern region into the Arabah. And the Arabah is the Jordan Valley. And we immediately know that what he's seeing is the land, the promised land. And this river will flow into the sea, and the sea that it will flow into is the Dead Sea. And he is told that this river that started as a trickle from this temple will transform the dead and accursed land Israel. That's where the river is going. This life-giving river will transform and cleanse and bring life to the land once again. So quite simply, our first point, a restored land. A restored land. This desolate land is revived by water. This river will make, have a look, verse 9, salt waters fresh. Where the river flows, everything will live. Everything will live. Verse 10, fishermen will stand along the shore and seas will teem with all fish of all kinds. Verse 11, swamps and marshes will not become fresh. Seems a bit bizarre until you realize they're left for salt. And it's intentional. There's preservation of such pockets of saltiness because salt was valuable. And this land will now bring economic benefit. And verse 12, fruit trees will be various and plentiful. Every month they will bear fruit. There'll never be a season when food is unavailable. And these leaves on these trees will bring healing. This land will be habitable once more. The curse has been lifted. Blessing once more abounds. And for the exiles here, here was a promise, not just of returning to a land, but a return to a land restored. Imagine, they're in Babylon. They've been hearing the reports of their homeland. They've heard Ezekiel 33, of their land in ruins and desolate and destroyed. And now they're being promised not a new land, not a new country, not to just remain where they are. They're promised that their land will be restored and renewed. Their land will flourish as it once had. Their land will have trees that grow fruit and always taste good. And in their land, food will always abound and seas will teem and trees will hang full. In their land, everything lives. Their once desolate land will become a lush green land for livestock to feed upon. Everything lives. Just imagine the sense of excitement. They're in Babylon. They're in exile. They're sitting there hearing this. They're beginning to talk amongst themselves. When do you think this will be? When will we return? Around the campfires that night, all that would have been spoken about would have been their homeland. I wonder if that tree I planted for the birth of my son is still there. I wonder whether our house still stands. I wonder whether my boat is still sailable. I wonder whether my nets are any good. What will my vineyard be like? How easy will it be to grow things again? How different do you think it will be? How much better do you think it will be? They would have gone to bed that night dreaming of their land restored, of their fruitful, restored homeland. See, part of God's restoration, it's not just that the people are restored back to him, but the land that he gave his people is also restored. The land is also cleansed and purified and made holy. It's restored to being the land as he promised, as he intended it for them. It's a land where the curse is removed and the blessing once more abounds. And part of God's restorative plan is not just for people, but also for the land. It's a truth we often lose sight of, isn't it? We often speak of the gospel restoring people, bringing them into a right relationship with God. And of course that's right. It's true. It's at the heart of the gospel. But it's not the whole gospel. See, Christ's death and resurrection brings about restoration also to God's creation. It's what Ezekiel 47 ultimately looks forward to, isn't it? It's why in Romans 8, Paul speaks of the creation waiting in eager expectation, awaiting when it will be liberated from its bondage to decay and brought into the glorious freedom of the children of God. It's why the whole of creation has been groaning as in the pains of childbirth as it awaits its restoration. Because the land and its people are inextricably linked. Our sin has defiled creation, just as Israel's sin defiled the land. When Adam and Eve sinned, creation was cursed. Sin defiled creation. It enslaved it. And to some degree, you could use the language of Ezekiel 33 to describe creation now. Creation's in ruins. It's not as it should be. Disease and famine wreak havoc, bringing desolation to many parts of creation. Natural disasters bring destruction and laying homes in ruin. Sin has defiled creation, enslaving it, cursing it, similar to the land in Ezekiel 33. And the promise of Ezekiel 47 is of a land where the curse will be removed, a land where everything lives. That's the key. Sin brings death. Here, everything lives. The curse is removed. It's a land where the seas teem with food and the trees are plentiful and fruitful. It's a land which is economically vibrant. And of course, you go to the New Testament and it picks this very idea up, doesn't it? Not just now speaking of Israel, as we've been seeing, but creation and the new heavens and the new earth. Turn to Revelation 22. You might want to keep a finger in 47 because we'll be back there. But Revelation 22. And verses 1 to 3. And as we read Revelation 22, you see it's a mirror language of Ezekiel 47. Just listen to the parallels. Revelation 22, verse 1. Then the angel showed me the river of the water of life. Ezekiel 47. So it's clear as crystal and flowing from the throne of God and of the Lamb. Ezekiel 47. It's the river that flows from the temple. And this river flows down the middle of the great street of the city. And on each side of the river stood the tree of life. Ezekiel 47. And it bears crops of fruit, yielding its fruit every month. Ezekiel 47. And the leaves of the tree are for the healing. Ezekiel 47. But now these trees are not just for one particular land, but Revelation 22, verse 2, for the nations. It's extended. It's far greater, the whole of creation. Then verse 3, Revelation 22, verse 3, here's the key. No longer will there be any curse. Curse is removed. Blessing abounds. Whole of creation is restored and cleansed because of Jesus' death and resurrection. It becomes a land which no longer bears the scars of sin or the effects of sin. It's a land that is perfectly restored and renewed. A land that is plentiful and fruitful. A land where everything lives. That's what the gospel promises. That's part of the gospel hope. That is the gospel reality. Everything is restored. Creation is renewed and restored and becomes the new heavens and the new earth. And all of Satan's work is undone. All that he brought about, that curse in Genesis 3, people are cursed and the land is cursed. It's all undone. Curse is removed. And God is now able to dwell with his people once more in a land that is restored, with a people that are restored. That's what Ezekiel 47 ultimately looks forward to, isn't it? Not just one small land of hope to a small exile nation in Babylon, but ultimately points forward to a greater restoration that is brought forward in the gospel, where the new heavens and the new earths, this land, this creation, renewed and restored and made perfect. And yet the truth is, I don't get that excited by it. I don't get excited as I should. And part of my problem is that I don't think biblically about heaven. I'm too quick to think of heavens, the new earth, as kind of just spiritually fluffy land. Too quick to think of heaven as just kind of out there, as if it's something I could just never imagine, could never get my head around. Randy Alcorn helpfully says, if you want to imagine heaven, begin by imagining this world perfected. Because that's what the gospel promises. Remember the exiles in Babylon, they're able to imagine the land because they're remembering the land as it was. And now they're hearing it even much better. They're totally getting it as they're sitting around their campfires, as they go to bed that night. And yet we don't get that excited. And partly, I think, is the problem that I have, which is you can't quite imagine it. But when you think of it as this world restored and renewed and recreated, with heaven coming down to be part of it, forming the new heavens and the new earth, you can begin to imagine that, can't you? And as you begin to imagine that, don't you find yourself just getting a little bit more excited? Because actually now it starts to become a little bit more real. I can start to begin to taste it and see it and feel it and understand it. Because it's not just a world out there, it's this creation restored and made new and renewed and perfected. But the other part of my problem, that I love this world too much. And I forget I'm an exile. And I'm a bit like an Israelite in Babylon who doesn't want to go back to Israel but wants to stay in Babylon. And I forget, actually, this is not my home. My home is this creation renewed and perfected with God dwelling at the heart. And when I begin to imagine the new heavens and the new earth as it is, as God intended, with God present at the heart of it, well, then I become like those exiles in Babylon, dreaming and speaking of the land restored, and get excited, because although I love this world, my home, this world restored with God dwelling at the center, is that much better. What will you be dreaming of and speaking of this evening, this week? How do you imagine what is to come? Biblically? Or have you embraced the world's views of heaven, the spiritual fluffy lands, the heavens out there that are just unimaginable to some degree? Or do you think biblically an Ezekiel 47 picture, a land restored. But secondly, Ezekiel 47 shows us a restored people. A restored people. See, within the land described in chapter 47, we see an abundantly restored people. See verse 9? Where this river flows, we see it's in it, everything will live. Verse 10, there are fishermen all along the shore, hauling in fish of many kinds. Verse 12, the fruit trees bear every month, which is then served as food. There's no shortage of food in this land. These same fruit trees, their leaves will bring healing, physical healing, spiritual healing, healing that is required from living in exile. So Ezekiel 47 pictures a people who are fully restored and living life in abundance. Spiritual restoration brings restored abundant life. See, chapters 40 to 46 picture the people being restored spiritually to God. Ezekiel 47 now shows that part of being spiritually restored is a restoration to an abundant life. See, imagine these exiles again in Babylon hearing this and they're clocking it. Their lives are far from abundant. They're exiles in a faraway land. They're presumably forced labor, hired help. They would not enjoy the comfort of home. You wouldn't be able to look at their life in any way and think to yourself, yep, that's the abundant life. That's life as it was intended. That's how God made us to be. No, you watch them work hard and eat minimally and suffer frequently at the hands of their captives. And Ezekiel 47 promises not only a return to the land, but to an abundant full life, to a land where food is plentiful and never spoilt, to a life of abundance and fullness, because spiritual restoration brings a restored abundant life. And it's not going to surprise you to hear that's exactly what Jesus promised, that he has come to bring. And he uses the very language of Ezekiel 47 to describe it. Turn with me to John 7 and verse 37. John 7 and verse 37. Jesus says this. On the last and greatest day of the feast, Jesus stood and said in a loud voice, "If anyone is thirsty, let him come to me and drink. Whoever believes in me, as the scripture has said, streams of living water will flow from within him." Now we need to understand the context to grasp the significance of what Jesus is saying. Jesus is at the Feast of Tabernacles. The climax of the Feast of Tabernacles was when water was symbolically poured out by the high priest as an offering to God. And they did it looking forward to the Lord's outpouring of the Spirit in the last days and a foretaste of the eschatological end time rivers of living water foreseen by Ezekiel and Zechariah. So as they poured out this water at this feast, they were looking forward to the day when these rivers would flow, bringing life. When these rivers would bring about restoration to the land and an abundant restored life for the people. And Jesus stands up at this feast and says, "Hey, if anyone is thirsty, let him come to me and drink. For whoever believes in me, as the scriptures have said, streams of living water will flow from him." In other words, if you want the spiritual life described in Ezekiel that you're looking forward to, if you want to be part of that restored land that Ezekiel looks to, come to me. Drink of the waters that I offer. In other words, believe in me and you will receive these streams of living water within you. You will receive this life-giving water and gain the spiritual life that Ezekiel speaks of. And John then helps us out to understand a little bit more. He says, verse 39, he makes it clear that this life-giving river is the Spirit. So the river in Ezekiel 47 is the Spirit bringing restoration to the land, just as he created the land. And it's the Spirit who spiritually restores and brings abundant life, just as he breathed life into dry bones in Ezekiel 37. And note, the Spirit brings streams, plural, of living water. It's abundance. So what Jesus will promise in John 10, I've come to bring life, life to the full, because spiritual restoration brings a restored abundant life, life to the full now and in eternity. And so the life these Israelites in Ezekiel's day were looking forward to, we can receive now because of Jesus. Because of Jesus' death and resurrection and him pouring out his Spirit, bringing life, bringing spiritual life, bringing abundant life. The life that we were always created for, a life that satisfies, a life that is content, a life that is full of joy. And in part we get that now, evidenced by the Spirit at work within us. But how much more that abundant life will be in that restored land, in that land where the river flows bringing life, in that land where everything will live. And imagine those exiles. And the excitement they felt hearing of an abundant life whilst enslaved in Babylon. How they would have yearned for it. And Jesus says, you can have it right now. You can have it right now by believing in me. And yet so often, as Jeremiah chapter 2 verse 13 tells us, we so often forsake the spring of living waters that Jesus offers. We forsake that life-giving water and we prefer instead to drink from cisterns that we have dug and drink water that is not life-giving but life-killing. We'd rather drink of the waters of this world and worship its idols and what it offers rather than drink the life-giving, life-abundant waters of Jesus. Abundant life cannot be found anywhere else. The whole of the book of Ezekiel teaches us and makes clear. The Israelites have tried to drink from every other possible water. They've drunk from the waters and the idols of all the other nations. They've drunk and thought to themselves, hey, do you know what? If we could have their land and if they could look after us and govern us, that would be much better. And they thought, hey, we'll try their gods. And they've drunk from the other gods. And they've drunk from the other gods' temples. And they've drunk from the waters of all the other nations. And what did they find? Those waters lead to slavery, bondage, in exile, ended up far from an abundant life. So let's not be fooled into drinking the waters of this world as if they could satisfy, as if they could bring life. Because drinking of the waters of this world brings slavery. Having more things won't bring you abundance. Working harder won't bring you abundance. Relationships won't bring you abundance. Only Jesus can give us what we thirst. Anything else equals bondage and slavery. Anything else, drinking of any other waters, is life-killing, not life-giving. And Jesus promises we can drink the waters and have the spiritual abundant life that Ezekiel 47 promises by believing and trusting in him. And yet how gracious Jesus is as well. Because on the days when our heads are turned and we drink from cisterns that are cracked and dry and not the life-giving river, because of Christ, our sins are forgiven and the Spirit keeps granting me that life-giving water I need. He gives us that life-giving. And then the New Testament also then builds on that Ezekiel 47 imagery in another way. See, in Ezekiel 47, the temple is the source of the life-giving river to the world. In the New Testament, who are the temples? We are the miniature temples, 2 Corinthians 6, where the Spirit of God dwells. And so now we, believers, are to be the source of blessing to all around us. In effect, we're to allow the life-giving river that now is flowing within us to flow from us. And how do we do that? By telling people the life-giving message of the gospel. By its transforming power, the gospel heals the spiritually dead, it makes folks alive in Christ and fruitful in service to God. We're to be life givers. were miniature temples, were to have a life-giving, life-transforming ministry as those who share the gospel. And so as you give out these little brown books, you're not just giving out little brown books, you're giving out life. Life. It's the gospel that transforms and brings life. And as those who have abundant life, what do we teach our children? If you have abundance, you share. We have abundant life, so we are to share that life with others, that others may know the fullness of life. We're little miniature temples, with streams of living water flowing within us, the Spirit. And we're to share that with a world that is desperately thirsty, with a world that is drinking from cisterns that are cracked and dried. A restored land, a restored people. And it would be amiss not to receive this last thing in Ezekiel 47, which is that it's all done by a restoring God. See, where does restoration begin in Ezekiel 47? The temple. God is the source. God is the source of life. God is the source of this life-giving river that flows from Him. It is He who transforms that which is dead and brings life. It is He that takes a dead land and restores it to where everything lives. It is He that takes a dead people and restores them spiritually and gives them abundant life. It is He that restores and transforms that which is dead and brings life. It's He who transforms a trickle of water into a raging river unable to be crossed. It is He who transforms the small into the massive. You only have to think about how the New Testament describes the kingdom of God as that which is a mustard seed that grows into the biggest tree in the garden with birds from everywhere flocking into it. It is He who transforms the small into the massive. It is He who transforms and restores that which is to the human eye small and insignificant into that which is majestic. And it is He that takes that which is profaned and makes it holy again. Do you remember a few weeks ago we talked about the profane and the holy? Profane is to make something not holy. And here in Ezekiel 47, we initially see a land that is not holy. And the whole of Ezekiel is shown as a temple that's not holy and a people that is not holy. And chapter 40 to 46 has shown us how God has taken that which is profane and now made it holy. So we have a holy temple and a holy people. And now He takes a land. And He makes it holy. He sanctifies it. And He makes it fit for His presence. It is He who restores the profane. It is He that is concerned for His creation and His people. So concerned, He sends His Son to restore them through His death and resurrection. The God we serve is a God who restores and who transforms both land and people. And so on those days when it looks like defeat, on days when it looks as if nothing could ever change or nothing could ever be restored, people could never change. This creation will seemingly, it seems that it will never change. Disaster keeps coming upon disaster. Ezekiel 47 screams, our God is a God who restores, who transforms, who brings life to dead, who restores dead lands and dead peoples to life, to a place where everything will live. Everything will live.